Did you find yourself thinking, as you listened to this week's Supreme Court debates, why don't they, on the other side, think the way I do? Well, our next guest says maybe they can't. Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist who studied morals, our sense of right and wrong, and he says that while morals bind us, they also blind us. And he has a message for his fellow liberals in particular, that while the left focuses on fairness and doing no harm, the right has a broader moral compass that includes freedom and the importance of authority, and liberals ignore the sanctity of that at their peril. Jonathan Haidt's new book is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And John, you say to start that when everyone's picking their moral arguments, they do it with a gut feeling and then they find the facts to support that?
We see this in every argument we ever have. It's easy to see in the other person. You can defeat their argument, but they don't admit you're right. They just go on and throw another argument at you. They're just thinking to find defenses. They're basically thinking like lawyers. We all think like lawyers. Even judges think like lawyers.
In fact, it's worse than that. You say we all actually think like press secretaries. Press secretaries. That's the way we're thinking.
That's right.
Well, that goes to a second thought that many on the left have. They have a hard time understanding why some of the people fighting the health care mandate would benefit from it. You also say in the book that's a big question. Why do rural and working class Americans vote Republican even though the Democratic Party wants to distribute money more evenly and presumably they'd benefit? So what's your answer to those questions?
Well, the first is if you think about politics as being about people trying to get as much stuff for themselves as they can, then you'll be puzzled as to why working class people generally prefer Republican presidents especially. But that's not what politics is about. Politics is not shopping. Politics is much more like religion. And the Democrats seem to have more trouble understanding this. Obama's campaign certainly was much more like politics. That's different. But the several presidential candidates before, it was all about, well, this program will give you that and this program gives you more. And people rejected that. People don't generally want the president to give them the most stuff. The presidency is like a priesthood. The president is the high priest of the American civil religion. And so when working class people vote against increasing the size of the federal government and increasing people's dependence on it, are they voting against their self-interest or are they voting for their moral interest? That is, the kind of strong America in which people have to take some responsibility for themselves. That's at least the way they see it.
Again, you say liberals are drawn to fairness.
What we find in our research is that liberals' notion of fairness tends to be more towards equality and compassion. That is, fairness is giving people who are suffering things that they need, protecting people. Conservatives focus much more on fairness as proportionality. That is, people should get in proportion to what they've put in. So they're fine with Social Security. They're much more uncomfortable with any sort of redistributive scheme that they think can be gamed or cheated.
This I think, might go to something you characterize as the mind is divided like a rider on an elephant. And you say the Republicans speak more directly to the elephant. Explain the rider and the elephant.
Most of our mind is these automatic unconscious processes. That's the elephant. Then we humans have this relatively new ability. We can think in words. We can reason things out. We can do math. And it's not really in control. You have to see conscious reasoning as like a servant. So the metaphor that I use is that the mind is divided like a rider on an elephant, like a small boy on the back of an elephant, and it's going to do what it darn well pleases. It's just much bigger and stronger.
Well, and you say Republicans are better at speaking to the elephant.
Yes. They understand that politics is more what goes on under the surface than what is explicitly said. Many commentators have argued that Republicans speak more to the emotions and Democrats speak more to the head.
I'm thinking that people could say, well, they speak more to the fears. You mentioned the Willie Horton ad from the Michael Dukakis campaign. And, you know, you may be better at speaking to the elephant, but isn't that speaking to the worst in people and to the fears in people?
Oh, yes, certainly. Appeals to racial fears are as low as can go. You know, the Democrats are not entirely innocent of this.
Sure.
I mean, there was the famous Daisy ad where, you know, Lyndon Johnson basically said, vote for Barry Goldwater and your kids will be destroyed in a nuclear war. I mean, both sides do this. We're able to see the low blows landed by the other side, but we often have trouble recognizing that our side will use similar tactics. both sides see threats that the other is blind to. Each side is sensitive to certain threats, and they're right to be afraid of them. And the other side says, nah, we're not worried about that one. Hey, why don't you worry about ours? And that's where we're stuck.
You ask liberals to look at artwork. You know, we've seen in the past cases of flags that were desecrated in the name of art, religious items that were put in what some would say would be a pornographic setting in the name of art. And you ask liberals to say, just think if it was a picture of Martin Luther King. And I hear that question, but then in reading it, I also thought, well, you're assuming all liberals thought it was okay to put religious artifacts in a pornographic setting.
Well, I'm a social scientist, so I'm not trying to explain what everybody does. I can say pretty confidently that when it comes to using the national flag or crucifixes or Bibles in a disrespectful way, if we hook people up to galvanic skin response machines, we're going to find a much bigger rise on the right than on the left. The basic rule here is follow the sacredness. See what each side holds sacred, and around it you'll find a zone of darkness and ignorance. So on the right, especially the religious right, it's the Bible and the flag and the crucifix, and it's as direct an attack on sacred values to do such thing. It produces an angry reaction. Well, what is it on the left? What do they hold sacred? I believe it's certain classes of victim groups that the left fought for and won and got rights and freedom for, especially African Americans and women. And I think if you understand that this is what holds a lot of the left together, especially the baby boomers, then you can understand what they get most upset about. When my own state, Virginia, did stupid, stupid, awful things like requiring a vaginal probe before a woman can have an abortion, I mean, this is as sacrilegious as putting a crucifix in urine. So you got to understand both sides' sacred values, and then when those are violated, you're going to see them get mad as hell.
Well, you talked about hooking people up. You have hooked brains up. You have seen what happens in the brain when partisanship is the issue. And there's something in our genes. What is it?
The way to think about it is this. Every trait ever measured just about is heritable. That means identical twins reared separately will be similar on it. So the genes, somehow or other, are making our brains to have certain kinds of tendencies that will lean one way or another in terms of, say, openness to experience and novelty. So if you imagine a brother and sister, let's say, one of whom has has a full set of genes that make them more interested in variety and diversity and travel, and that brother, let's say, is just going to be more interested in talking with different people and traveling the world. And if his sister has a reaction to novelty that's a little more cautious and sees threats more readily, she'll have different tastes. And as they grow up, this is going to lead them into different social groups.
And what about the idea that a partisan brain gets reinforced, that there's almost an addictive nature to partisanship?
That's right. You're referring to a study by Drew Weston in which they brought people into an fMRI scanner, showed them slides of their favorite candidate apparently contradicting himself. And that's upsetting. It's disturbing. They were kind of squirming. And you can see that in the brain. And then when they introduced an additional piece of information to say, well, actually, it's not a contradiction. Actually, you know, Bush said he liked Ken Lay of Enron, but then he was deeply ashamed and angry afterwards. Ah, well, that resolves the conflict. At least I can see that, you know, oh, my man is a good man. At that moment, they saw areas of the brain rich in dopamine, the parts that give you a feeling of reward or pleasure were lighting up. So the point is that our partisan loyalties are passionate, and we feel good when we see the other side make a mistake or suffer, and we feel good when our side does something or has some sort of victory.
Jonathan Haidt, a social psychologist at the University of Virginia and at NYU this semester. He draws on Plato, Kant, anthropology, and scientific study to write his new book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. He says moral reasoning is a gut thing and that liberals in particular need to be more understanding of conservatives. John was a 21-year-old liberal atheist when he went to India and was at first put off by a sex-segregated, rigid society, but he made friends and began to see beauty in a moral code that emphasizes duty and service to group. And when he came home, he says he felt better understanding American conservatives. John, you say that's the big problem in the U.S., that we don't get to cross cultures.
As a social and moral psychologist, I think the thing we've got to keep in mind here is that our morality isn't just an individual affair. It's not like, oh, I've got my morality and I'm all concerned about that person or that issue. Morality is really part of our tribal nature. Morality is about the team you belong to. So if you look at people's bumper stickers, I mean, sometimes they're showing off their personal accomplishments, but, you know, it's what sports teams, what bands they like, what school they went to. We evolved to be tribal creatures, and it's really a miracle that we're able to live together in gigantic groups with very little violence. So, you know, in a way, what I want to do in the book is, you know, lower people's expectations. We're actually doing pretty well as a species and as a country. One thing that I think we all need to look for is the opportunity to at least meet people and talk with people from the other side. One of the causes of our dysfunction now is that we've moved into sort of gated moral communities in which many people on the left never really meet or socialize with people on the right and vice versa. And if we're not persuaded just by reasons floating out in reason space. We're persuaded by relationships and emotions. If you have a friend who thinks differently than you, then you can listen to them. But if you simply come across the same argument on the internet, you're just going to reject it because your intuitions are against it, and then you'll find evidence to support your rejection of it.
You say break up ideological segregation, not just the way people live, but the way politicians are now organizing us to vote, gerrymandering. You say that something's got to be done about that. And also the fact that it used to be that politicians had to live with their families in Washington.
That's right. Most chose to. And when Newt Gingrich came in as Speaker in 1995, he made some changes that I think have really done a number on us. He changed the calendar so that pretty much everybody could just fly in on Tuesday and then fly out on Thursday or Friday morning or whatever. So they're only in town for a couple days. They do fierce battle. They rent an apartment. You know, a few congressmen together from the same party will share a space. So it's just a tribal huddle, and then they go back to their districts. In fact, I heard David Brooks say the other day, one of our problems is the decline of bourbon. These guys used to drink together a lot, and they don't drink together anymore across party lines. So there's a group called NoLabels.org that has a bunch of proposals, one of which I really like, is change the legislative calendar so that they have to be there in session 3 weeks a month, Monday through Friday. That will strongly encourage them to actually rent an apartment or even buy a house in Washington and move there with their family.
John Haidt, you have to say some provocative things. You talk about yourself. Post 9/11, how you wanted to do something, show some solidarity with your country and, you know, maybe put out a flag, but you felt as a liberal and a college professor, you couldn't do that. And, you know, I can hear other liberals saying, well, wait a second, Rachel Maddow is an army brat. You know, she's a mm-hmm. big mm-hmm. supporter of the military and very much on the left, saying, well, that's just you. You know, I don't have that problem. And it's not my problem, this lack of communication with the right. They're the ones pointing fingers at me. What do you say to them?
Well, first, of course, there's diversity on both sides. But when you look at the polling data, there was recently a Pew poll on you know, people's attitudes about, for example, capitalism. You know, and the right is very in favor of it. The left is ambivalent. I don't know the polling data on attitudes about America. But what I can say as an academic, there's a lot of ambivalence. America's done some great things. America's done some terrible things. Now, that's true. I mean, that really is true. But the right sacralizes America. The left does not. And while that's the correct position to take from an academic standpoint, it puts you at a disadvantage in terms of national politics. The president is supposed to talk about national greatness. And when Obama was asked about it, he gave really the academically correct answer, which is he said, yes, I think America's a great nation in just the way that the British and the Greeks think that their nations are great. I mean, he's right. But as president, you're not supposed to talk that way. And Republicans are really, really good at talking in a way that makes them fit for the post of high priest of the nation.
This is the tough question, John Haidt. It sounds like you're saying liberals have to become more like Republicans. You started off by saying maybe more sensitive to what you see as real values, but it sounds like you're saying be more acquiescent.
No. I'm not saying be more acquiescent. I'm not even saying move more to the center. I'm saying two things. Liberals have to at least understand what conservative values are, and stop committing so much sacrilege. Stop doing things that will just provoke a hornet's nest of reaction. And the birth control mandate is exactly what I'm talking about.
All Catholic institutions don't have to pay for it. That was the president's compromise.
But it's too late now. What I'm trying to say is this. If the left would at least understand the values of the right, they could at least navigate around them without committing sacrilege, without pissing them off so much. The second thing, and this is the deeper message, liberals, I believe, need to go through the process that the conservatives went through in the 70s. They need to figure out what they stand for in the 21st century. And I've talked with a lot of liberals and some Democrats and people who are supposed to be doing this sort of work. And all they seem to be thinking about is what should we say about healthcare? And the Republicans, with Ronald Reagan especially, they came up with this, with a vision of America and a set of values, and they've stuck with it. They've had to make no changes since 1980. Whereas on the left, it's very hard to get them to say what they stand for. I think what they should stand for is what the Democrats always have stood for back to the early 19th century, which is equal opportunity for all, special privileges for none. And Democrats will think they stand for that, but actually it's a party of special interest. They stand for special privileges for certain groups and not others. And I think this is why the white working class hates them, because they don't really stand for, they're not as concerned about class as they are about race, for example. So until the Democrats figure out some sort of elevating position, some sort of noble mission statement, and can stick to it, I think they're going to just be sort of fumbling around as they've been for the last 20 years.
Jonathan Haidt, social psychologist at the University of Virginia. His new book is The Righteous Mind: Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.